Larry Merkuliev, hello.
Hello, and hello to your listeners. We usually say Ang Wan, which is the way we greet each other every day, which means hello, my other self.
Thank you very much for taking the time to join us. And I thought we could start off just with a definition for people that might be listening to this and hearing about it for the first time. When we talk about traditional knowledge, what are we talking about, and what's the best way to define it?
Well, it's often misunderstood, but it's a way of living that people with intimate and sustained contact with their environment have carried on for thousands of years.
Talk to us about some of the issues, conflicts, and problems that you see coming up nowadays.
Well, I think that challenges that we have now are the same as they were 30 years ago. And the challenge has been cross-cultural, of course. We want to engage the Western scientists in discussions about the basic nature of cultures in the North, and immerse them in that and let them understand that we no longer want to have traditional knowledge incorporated into Western science. We want to be full partners. And that means that researchers should go into communities and not have a formula or a set mission that they have to fulfill without incorporating the ways and priorities of the local community. And that's still a challenge. I've met many people around the world, traditional peoples, and they tell me about what the challenges they encounter, which are very similar to what we encountered on St. Paul Island, where I was born and raised, and have lived this traditional upbringing. My generation was the last generation that had a traditional upbringing. And in the 1980s, we noticed, of course, we first noticed the effects of climate change in the 70s with adult birds with breastbones sticking out, chest muscles caved in, chicks falling off cliff ledges in larger numbers than ever in living memory. Northern fur seals, which is 80% of the population of northern fur seals, breed on the Pribilof Islands, which is what St. Paul is part of. And we noticed that the fat was so thin that we could see light through the skin, which we never noted before. And we noticed stellar sea lions chasing after seal pups in greater frequency. So we knew that there was an ecosystem-wide phenomena occurring, and it was food-related. And at that time, the scientists were just wondering, why are these species declining? And they muddled around with their hypotheses, which were incorrect at that time. And so in 1983, we contacted the Dean of School of Fisheries at the University of Alaska and asked him if he could help us put together a multidisciplinary scientific conference where the scientists would compare their information with each other. But we found out that the scientists from the different disciplines use different methodologies and couldn't compare their information. So we wanted to have this conference. And so he agreed, and we started on it. And I talked with every field scientist that was doing any research in the Bering Sea, and they agreed that this is needed. And so we are well on our way to planning this when the Dean of the School of Fisheries calls me and said he has to drop out. And I asked him why, and he said, well, the higher-ups said that if I engage in this, they will pull my Kennedy Salt and Stall funds, which is 40% of my department budget, and these are federal funds from the U.S. And so he said that left me no choice. So he dropped out, and very shortly after, all this, the field scientists dropped out. And then, not to be held up, we contacted the him again and asked him who could review the scientific information that was done in fisheries in the Bering Sea. And he recommended a fellow in the Great Salt Bay Experimental Station in Maine. And we contacted him. He agreed to do an audit of the modeling system that was used for fisheries in the Bering Sea. And he produced a report that we turned in to the managing body of fisheries in the North Pacific. And they turned that report to the very entity in Washington State that produced the report for the statistics for the fish in the Bering Sea in the first place. And from that point on, we never heard anything else. And then from that point, Ian Fletcher, who was the gentleman at Great Salt Bay Experimental Station, Maine, got labeled as off the wall kind of thing, and he lost all of his government contracts very shortly after. And so we realized that U.S. scientists were too vested in the system, so we decided to go out of the United States and contact the Russian Academy of Sciences, the Cherkasov Institute of Oceanology, figuring that maybe a Russian scientist might look at this, and I was able to get a hold of Michael Flint, who was the deputy director for the Cherkasov Institute of Oceanology, and he oversaw 1,000 marine scientists, so he was the right person that we need to talk with. And he was very excited about this idea of joint venturing with Native people of Alaska to study this issue. And he himself was a notable scientist. He studied why the anchovy fishery collapsed off of Chile. He was the main scientist that did that, and other kinds of things like that. Anyway, he brought over 7 marine scientists.
And those were Russian scientists.
Yeah, Russian scientists. And we agreed that the traditional knowledge and wisdom of our people will be used equal to that of his science. And we studied for 4 years, produced a report that must have been at least a foot thick, it got published in every country that was interested in it, including Saudi Arabia, of all places, but it could not be printed or published in the U.S. because the scientific review team considered this they called it primitive methodologies.
And this was in the 1980s.
Yep, and this was referring to the fact that they joint ventured with Unungan people. But that report, if the U.S. would pay attention to it, could change the way that marine science is done in the U.S.
And what do you think made it that the Russian scientists were able to deal with the community of St. Paul as equals? What do you think is different about the Russian approach and the American approach at that time?
Well, they had something that was totally refreshing and new, and that is called transdisciplinary science. And not multidisciplinary science, but transdisciplinary, where every member of their team who had worked together for 20 years were able to work equally proficiently in the other person's specialty. And we thought, well, this is closer to the indigenous way of knowing things. And he saw that too.
And do you remember at the time what the community thought or how the community felt when you heard that, you know, the traditional knowledge was characterized as primitive knowledge?
Well, it's obvious what the reactions were. People were very, very disappointed. And it reaffirmed for a lot of people that this science, as it was conducted then, could not be trusted.
So it creates a mistrust even more than was there before.
Oh, yes. And, of course, it has been, just like every other Native community across the North, a mixed kind of thing where the approaches used by scientists didn't accommodate local needs.
And does that mean reporting back the findings to the community so that they can implement maybe some of those findings and understanding what's going on, or are you speaking about something else?
Well, that means that scientists, when they consider fulfilling their mission, part of their mission should be that they first contact the communities that are going to, that they're interested in, and then talk about how or what they could do, which includes the local priorities. And frequently, these local priorities are more of what should be studied than the mission of the scientists.
And if we compare, you know, this experience in the 80s, what improvements have you seen in Alaska since then when scientists come up to do research? Where do you think some of the progress has been made?
Well, we have been working hard at it for many, many years, and I think that we have impressed upon the scientific community and the various research institutes that they've got to involve the local community more than just being recipients of what the department's mission is, but must include the local priorities. And it's starting to slowly sink in.
What do you think the remaining resistance can be attributed to? Is it just a complete maybe misunderstanding of the North? Is there something where traditional knowledge maybe isn't still as accepted as people lead us to believe? What do you think the sort of tension points still are?
Well, the main point, I think, Michael Flint of the Shershoff Institute and myself, we engaged in a survey of scientific methodologies and research techniques around the world and compared it to what was happening in the Bering Sea. And what we found was that there are major institutional barriers. The policies and the directives, for example, each department has their mission, and many, many times that mission is statutorily mandated. And so they have to follow that mission. And they don't have much money or policy directives to work these partnerships with Native peoples. And so if a scientist engages in that kind of partnership, their careers are usually short-lived. And so that's a major concern. Then there's cross-cultural issues where scientists don't make it a priority, or policy-wise in the institution, they don't make it a priority to ensure that those who work with Native people get cross-cultural training by people who lived those cultures.
Is there any concrete examples, you know, from recent years that come to mind on your part where the partnership between traditional knowledge and science in Alaska has gone well, or where there's been something very fruitful that has come out of it?
Well, of course, most people know about the Inupiat and the whales, the bowhead whales that they hunt. They have their own scientific regime within the international whaling agreements, and that kind of thing works real well. They also do that the same kind of thing with walrus. When they do that, the scientists eventually become advocates for this way of doing things.
Overall, if you looked at the situation in Alaska now, how would you characterize it?
Well, it's slowly moving in the right direction. It's not anywhere near fast enough. And especially the elders here in Alaska and around the world, really, they feel like we have pushed Mother Earth's life support system to the edge, so that now it's a question about whether or not human beings are going to survive. And given that, they feel that these scientists should take guidance from the indigenous people as to what they focus on. And I to give you an example, you know, when they were studying why fur seals were declining, and they're still declining now in the Pribilof Islands, they're down by 60% maybe from what it was 30 years ago, and they were studying for 10 years. They studied the high sea drift net entanglement as the major cause for the decline, and of course we told them when they first started that was the wrong direction. They're pursuing the wrong hypotheses. And sure enough, 10 years later, they found out that we were right. In 1990, the scientists finally got together in an interdisciplinary meeting of the kind that we were calling for in 1983 and concluded that food stress was the main problem. Now, scientists can shave off decades even of searching and hone in better on what the real causes for these declines are.
What about for the rest of the world? What's at stake for us all around the global community if science doesn't incorporate indigenous knowledge more into their work, and specifically in the Arctic where climate change is having such a drastic impact?
Well, first of all, I think that we should get away from this idea of that this science is the only science available. Our science is really excellent. For example, the people have survived and thrived for thousands of years based on this kind of native way. And it's 100% accurate when you consider that the decisions that individual hunters or fishermen or gatherers make when they go out, it has to be perfect. Otherwise, someone may die or they may be unsuccessful, which means that the community doesn't go hungry, all these kinds of things that people should consider is that we are 100% accurate. Yupik elders here, for example, they talked about how they know what's happening to salmon, and they know it with 100% accuracy what the salmon run is going to be the next year. Scientists still can't do that. And what the urgency is that we have to arrive at solutions to this climate crisis, we call it. And that was the conclusion of the global conference of indigenous peoples on on climate change is that it is a climate crisis, not a climate change. And this crisis is threatening human beings. And we don't have much time, according to the elders.
Larry Mirkulia, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.